that she wants things to be right for you, no matter what the cost.
She wants things her way. And that isn't anything new. She's always wanted things her way.
That she thinks the right thing for you is whatever she thinks the right thing is goes without saying, Michael said. But what makes you think you are so different? Or better? You were after her ass in there, and she knew it. So did I.
She started it.
No, you started it. When you brought the car home. You knew how she felt. And she's right about another thing. You've changed. From that first day you came home with Dennis and said you'd bought a car. That's when it started. Do you think that hasn't upset her or me? To have your kids start exhibiting personality traits you didn't even know existed?
Hey, Dad, come on. That's a little...
We never see you. You're always working on your car or out with Lee.
You're starting to sound just like her.
Michael suddenly grinned, but it was a sad grin.
You're wrong about that.
Just as wrong as you can be. She sounds like her. And you sound like her.
But I?
Just sound like the guy in charge of some dumb UN peacekeeping force that's about to get its collective ass shot off.
Arnie slumped a little. His hand found the car again and began caressing. Caressing.
All right, he said. I guess I see what you mean. I don't know why you want to let her push you around like that, but...
Okay.
The sad, humiliated grin remained, a little like the grin of a dog that has chased a woodchuck a long piece on a hot summer day. Maybe some things get to be a way of life, and maybe there are compensations that you can't understand and I can't explain, like, well, I love her, you know?
Arnie shrugged. So, what now?
Can we go for a ride?
Arnie looked surprised, then pleased. Sure, hop in. Any place in particular?
The airport.
Arnie's eyebrows went up. The airport? Why?
I'll tell you as we go.
What about Regina?
Your mother's gone to bed,
Michael said quietly, and Arnie had the good grace to flush a little himself.
Arnie drove firmly and well. Christine's new sealed-beam headlights cut the early dark in a clean, deep tunnel of light. He passed the Gilder's house, then turned left onto Elm Street at the stop sign and started out toward JFK Drive. I-376 took them to I-278 and then out toward the airport. Traffic was light. The engine muttered softly through new pipes. The dashboard instrument panel glowed a mystic green. Arnie turned on the radio and found WDIL, the AM station from Pittsburgh that plays only oldies. Gene Chandler was chanting, "The Duke of Earl."
This thing runs like a dream, Michael Cunningham said. He sounded awed.
Thanks, Arnie said, smiling.
Michael inhaled deeply. It smells new.
A lot of it is. These seat covers sent me back $80. Part of the money Regina was bitching about. I went to the library and got a lot of books and tried to copy everything the best I could, but it hasn't been as easy as people might think.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, the 58 Plymouth Fury wasn't anybody's idea of a classic car, so no one wrote much about it, even in the car retrospective volumes. American Car, American Classics, Cars of the 1950s, things like that. The 58 Pontiac was a classic. Only the second-year Pontiac made the Bonneville model, and the 58 T-Bird with the rabbit-ear fins, that was the last really great Thunderbird, I think, and...
I had no idea you knew so much about old cars, Michael said. How long have you been harboring this interest, Arnie?
He shrugged, vaguely. Anyway, the other problem was just that LeBay himself customized the original Detroit rolling stock. Plymouth didn't offer a Fury in red and white, for one thing. And I've been trying to restore the car more the way he had it than the way Detroit meant it to be. So I've just been sort of flying by the seat of my pants.
Why do you want to restore it the way LeBay had it?
That vague shrug again.
I don't know. It just seems like the right thing to do.
Well, I think you're doing a hell of a job.
Thank you.
His father leaned toward him, looking at the instrument panel.
What are you looking at?
Arnie asked a little sharply.
I'll be damned, Michael said. I've never seen that before.
What? Arnie glanced down.
Oh, the odometer.
It's running backward, isn't it?
The odometer was indeed running backward. At that time, on the evening of November 1st, it read 79,500 and some odd miles. As Michael watched, the tenths of a mile indicator rolled from 0.2 to 0.1 to 0. As it went back to 0.9, the actual miles slipped back by 1.
Michael laughed. That's one thing you missed, son.
Arnie smiled, a small smile.
That's right, he said. Will says there's a wire crossed in there someplace. I don't think I'll fool with it. It's sort of neat having an odometer that runs backward.
Is it accurate?
Huh?
Well, if you go from our house to Station Square, would it subtract 5 miles from the total?
Oh, Arnie said. I get you. No, it's not accurate at all. Turns back 2 or 3 miles for every actual mile traveled. Sometimes more. Sooner or later, the speedometer cable will break, and when I replace that, it'll take care of itself.
Michael, who had had a speedometer cable or two break on him in his time, glanced at the needle for the characteristic jitter that indicated trouble there. But the needle hung dead still, just above 40. The speedometer seemed fine. It was only the odometer that had gotten funky. And did Arnie really believe that the speedometer and odometer ran off the same cables? Surely not. He laughed and said,
"That's weird, son."
"Why the airport?" Arnie asked. "I'm going to treat you to a 30-day parking stub," Michael said. $5, cheaper than Darnell's garage. "And you can get your car out whenever you want it. The airport's a regular stop on the bus run. End of the line, in fact."
"Holy Christ, that's the craziest thing I ever heard,"
Arnie shouted. He pulled into the turnaround drive of a darkened dry cleaner shop.
"I'm to take the bus 20 miles out to the airport to get my car when I need it? It's like something out of Catch-22. No, no way."
He was about to say something more when he was suddenly grabbed by the neck.
"You listen," Michael said. "I'm your father, so you listen to me. Your mother was right, Arnie. You've gotten unreasonable, more than unreasonable, in the last couple of months. You've gotten downright peculiar."
"Let go of me," Arnie said, struggling in his father's grip. Michael didn't let go, but he loosened up.
"I'll put it in perspective for you," he said. "Yes, the airport is a long way to come. But the same quarter that would take you to Darnell's will take you out here. There are parking garages closer in, but there are more incidents of theft and vandalism in the city. The airport is, by contrast, quite safe."
"No public parking lot is safe."
"Second, it's cheaper than a downtown garage and much cheaper than Darnell's."
"That's not the point, and you know it."
"Maybe you're right," Michael said. "But you're missing something too, Arnie. You're missing the real point."
"Well, suppose you tell me what the real point is."
"All right. I will."
Michael paused for a moment, looking steadily at his son. When he spoke, his voice was low and even, almost as musical as his recorder. "Along with any sense of what is reasonable, you seem to have totally lost your sense of perspective. You're almost 18, in your last year at public school. I think you've made up your mind not to go to Horlicks. I've seen the college brochures you've brought home."
"No, I'm not going to Horlicks," Arnie said.
He sounded a little calmer now.
"Not after all of this.
You have no idea how badly I want to get away."
"Or maybe you do."
"Yes, I do. And maybe that's best. Better than this constant abrasion between you and your mother. All I ask is that you not tell her yet. Wait until you have to submit the application papers."
Arnie shrugged, promising nothing either way.
"You'll be taking your car to school, that is, if it's still running."
"It'll be running.
And if it's a school that allows freshmen to have cars on campus."
Arnie turned toward his father, surprised out of his smoldering anger, surprised and uneasy.
This was a possibility he had never considered.
"I won't go to a school that says I can't have my wheels," he said. His tone was one of patient instruction, the sort of voice an instructor with a class of mentally retarded children might use.
"You see?" Michael asked. "She's right. Basing your choice of a college on the school's policy concerning freshmen and cars is totally irrational. You've gotten obsessed with this car."
"I wouldn't expect you to understand."
Michael pressed his lips together for a moment. "Anyway, what's running out to the airport on the bus to pick up your car if you want to take Lee out? It's an inconvenience, granted, but not really a major one. It means you won't use it unless you have to, for one thing, and you'll save gas money. Your mother can have her little victory. She won't have to look at it." Michael paused and then smiled his sad grin again. "She doesn't see it as money flying away. Both of us know that. She sees it as your first decisive step away from her. From us. I guess she... Oh, shit, I don't know."
He stopped, looking at his son. Arnie looked back, thoughtfully.
"Take it to college with you. Even if you choose a campus that doesn't allow freshmen to have cars on campus, there are ways to get around."
"Like parking it at the airport?"
"Yes, like that. When you come home for weekends, Regina will be so glad to see you, she'll never mention the car. Hell, she'll probably get out there in the driveway and help you wash it and turtle wax it just so she can find out what you're doing. 10 months. Then it'll be over. We can have peace in the family again. Go on, Arnie. Drive." Arnie pulled out of the dry cleaners and back into traffic.
"Is this thing insured?" Michael asked abruptly.
Arnie laughed.
"Are you kidding? If you don't have liability insurance in this state and you get in an accident, the cops kill you. Without liability, it'd be your fault even if the other car fell out of the sky and landed on top of you. It's one of the ways the shitters keep kids off the roads in Pennsylvania."
Michael thought of telling Arnie that a disproportionate number of fatal accidents in Pennsylvania, 41%, involved teenage drivers. Regina had read the statistic to him as part of a Sunday supplement article, rolling that figure out in slow, apocalyptic tones. 41%, shortly after Arnie bought his car. And decided it wasn't anything Arnie would want to hear. Not in his present mood.
"Just liability?"
They were passing under a reflecting sign which read, "Left lane for airport." Arnie put on his blinker and changed lanes. Michael seemed to relax a little.
"You can't get collision insurance until you're 21. I mean that. Those shitting insurance companies are all as rich as Croesus, but they won't cover you unless the odds are stacked outrageously in their favor."
There was a bitter, somehow weakly peevish note in Arnie's voice that Michael had never heard before. And although he said nothing, he was startled and a little dismayed by his son's choice of words. He had assumed Arnie used that sort of language with his peers, or so he later told Dennis Gilder, apparently totally unaware of the fact that up until his senior year, Arnie had really had no peers, except for Gilder. But he had never used it in front of Regina and himself.
"Your driving record and whether or not you had driver ed don't have anything to do with it," Arnie went on. "The reason you can't get collision is because their fucking actuarial tables say you can't get collision. You can get it at 21, only if you're willing to spend a fortune. Usually the premiums end up being more than the car books for until you're 23 or so, unless you're married. Oh, the shitters have got it all figured out. They know how to walk it right to you, all right."
Up ahead, the airport lights glowed, runways outlined in mystic parallels of blue light.
"If anyone ever asks me what the lowest form of human life is, I'll tell them. It's an insurance agent."
"You've made quite a study of it," Michael commented. He didn't quite dare to say anything else. Arnie seemed only waiting to fly into a fresh rage.
"I went around to 5 different companies. In spite of what Mom said, I'm not anxious to throw my money away."
"And straight liability was the best you could do?"
"Yeah, that's right. $650 a year.
Michael whistled.
"That's right," Arnie agreed.
another twinkling sign advising that the two left-hand lanes were for parking, the right lanes for departures. At the entrance to the parking lot, the way split again. To the right was an automated gate where you took a ticket for short-term parking. To the left was the glass booth where the parking lot attendant sat, watching a small black-and-white TV and smoking a cigarette. Arnie sighed.
Maybe you're right. Maybe this is the best solution all the way around.
Of course it is, Michael said, relieved. Arnie sounded more like his old self now, and that hard light had died out of his eyes. 10 months, that's all.
Sure.
He drove up to the booth, and the attendant, a young guy in a black-and-orange high school sweater with the Libertyville logo on the pockets, pushed back the glass partition and leaned out.
Help you? I'd like a 30-day ticket,
Arnie said, digging for his wallet. Michael put his hand over Arnie's. This one's my treat, he said. Arnie pushed his hand away gently but firmly and took his wallet out.
It's my car, he said. I'll pay my own way.
I only want it, Michael began.
I know,
Arnie said.
But I mean it.
Michael sighed.
I know you do.
You and your mother. Everything will be fine if you do it my way. Arnie's lips tightened momentarily, and then he smiled.
Well,
yeah, he said. They looked at each other and both burst out laughing. At the instant that they did, Christine stalled. Up until then, the engine had been ticking over with unobtrusive perfection. Now, it just quit. The oil and amp idiot lights came on. Michael raised his eyebrows.
Say what?
I don't know, Arnie answered, frowning.
I never did that before.
He turned the key and the engine started at once.
Nothing, I guess, Michael said. I'll want to check the timing later in the week,
Arnie muttered. He gunned the engine and listened carefully. And in that instant, Michael thought that Arnie didn't look like his son at all. He looked like someone else, someone much older and harder. He felt a brief but extremely nasty lance of fear in his chest.
Hey, do you want this ticket, or are you just going to sit there all night talking about your timing?
The parking lot attendant asked. He looked vaguely familiar to Arnie, the way people do when you've seen them moving around in the corridors at school, but don't have anything else to do with them.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Arnie passed him a $5 bill, and the attendant gave him a time ticket.
Back of the lot, the attendant said. Be sure to revalidate it 5 days before the end of the month if you want the same space again.
Right.
Arnie drove to the back of the lot, Christine's shadow growing and shrinking as they passed under the hooded sodium arc lights. He found a vacant space and backed Christine in. As he turned off the key, he grimaced and put a hand to his lower back.
That's still bothering you?
Michael asked.
Only a little, Arnie said. I was almost over it, and it came back on me yesterday. I must have lifted something wrong. Don't forget to lock your door.
They got out and locked up. Once out of the car, Michael felt better. He felt closer to his son. And maybe just as important, he felt less that he had played the impotent fool with his jingling cap of bells in the argument that had taken place earlier. Once out of the car, he felt as if he might have salvaged something, maybe a lot, out of the night.
Let's see how fast that bus really is, Arnie said,
and they began to walk across the parking lot toward the terminal, companionably close together. Michael had formed an opinion of Christine on the ride out to the airport. He was impressed with the job of restoration Arnie had done, but he disliked the car itself. Disliked it intensely. He supposed it was ridiculous to hold such feelings about an inanimate object, but the dislike was there all the same, big and unmistakable, like a lump in the throat. The source of the dislike was impossible to isolate. It had caused bitter trouble in the family, and he supposed that was the real reason, but it wasn't all. He hadn't liked the way Arnie seemed when he was behind the wheel, somehow arrogant and petulant at the same time, like a weak king. The impotent way he had railed about the insurance, his use of that ugly and striking word, shitters. Even the way the car had stalled when they laughed together. and it had a smell. You didn't notice it right away, but it was there. Not the smell of new seat covers. That was quite pleasant. This was an undersmell. Bitter. Almost, but not quite, secret. It was an old smell. Well, Michael told himself, the car is old. Why in God's name do you expect it to smell new? And that made undeniable sense. In spite of the really fantastic job Arnie had done of restoring it, the Fury was 20 years old. That bitter, moldy smell might be coming from old carpeting in the trunk, or old matting under the new floor mats. Perhaps it was coming from the original padding under the bright new seat covers. Just a smell of age. And yet that undersmell, low and vaguely sickening, bothered him. It seemed to come and go in waves, sometimes very noticeable, at other times completely undetectable. It seemed to have no specific source. At its worst, it smelled like the rotting corpse of some small animal, a cat, a woodchuck, maybe a squirrel, that had gotten into the trunk or maybe crawled up into the frame and then died there. Michael was proud of what his son had accomplished and very glad to get out of his son's car. Chapter 22. Sandy. The parking lot attendant that night, every night from 6 until 10 as a matter of fact, was a young man named Sandy Galton, the only one of Buddy Repperton's close circle of hoodlum friends who had not been in the smoking area on the day Repperton had been expelled from school. Arnie didn't recognize him, but Galton recognized Arnie. Buddy Repperton, out of school and with no interest in initiating the procedures that might have gotten him readmitted at the beginning of the spring semester in January, had gone to work at the gas station run by Don Vandenberg's father. In the few weeks he had been there, he had already begun a number of fairly typical scams, short-changing gas customers who looked as if they might be in too big a hurry to count the bills he gave back to them, running the retread game, which consists of charging the customer for a new tire and then actually putting on a retread and pocketing the $15 to $60 difference, running the similar used parts game, plus selling inspection stickers to kids from the high school in nearby Horlicks, kids desperate to keep their death traps on the road. The station was open 24 hours a day, and Buddy worked the late shift from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. Around 11 o'clock, Moochie Welch and Sandy Galton were apt to drop by in Sandy's old dented Mustang. Richie Trelawney might come by in his Firebird. And Don, of course, was in and out all the time, when he wasn't goofing off at school. By midnight on any given weeknight, there might be 6 or 8 guys sitting around in the office, drinking beer out of dirty teacups, passing around a bottle of Buddy's Texas Driver, doing a joint or maybe a little hash, farting, telling dirty jokes, swapping lies about how much pussy they were getting, and maybe helping Buddy fiddle around with whatever was up on the lift. During one of these late-night gatherings in early November, Sandy happened to mention that Arnie Cunningham was parking his machine in the long-term lot out at the airport. He had, in fact, bought a 30-day ticket. Buddy, whose usual demeanor during these late-night bull sessions was one of sullen withdrawal, tipped his cheap contour plastic chair abruptly back down on all four legs and put his bottle of driver down on the windshield wiper cabinet with a bang. "What did you say?" he asked. "Cunningham? Oh, cunt face?" "Yeah," Sandy said, surprised and a little uneasy. "That's him." "You're sure? The guy that got me kicked out of school?" Sandy looked at him with mounting alarm. "Yeah, why?" "And he's got a 30-day ticket, which means he's parked in the long-term lot." "Yeah? Maybe his folks didn't want him to have it at..." Sandy trailed off. Buddy Repperton had begun to smile. It was not a pleasant sight, that smile, and not only because the teeth it revealed were already going rotten. It was as if somewhere, some terrible machinery had just whined into life and was beginning to cycle up and up to full running speed. Buddy looked around from Sandy to Don to Moochie Welch to Richie Trelawney. They looked back at him, interested and a little scared. "Cunt face," he said in a soft, marveling voice. "Oh, cunt face got his machine street legal, and his funky folks, they've got him parking it out at the airport." He laughed. Moochie and Don exchanged a glance that was somehow both uneasy and eager. Buddy leaned toward them, elbows on the knees of his jeans. "Listen," he said. Chapter 23, Arnie and Lee. WDIL was on the car radio, and Dion was singing Runaround Sue in his tough, streetwise voice. But neither of them was listening. His hand had slipped up under the T-shirt she was wearing and had found the soft glory of her breasts, capped with nipples that were tight and hard with excitement. Her breath came in short, steep gasps, and for the first time, her hand had gone where he wanted it, where he needed it, into his lap, where it pressed and turned and moved, without experience, but with enough desire to make up for the lack. He kissed her, and her mouth opened wide. Her tongue was there, and the kiss was like inhaling the clean aroma taste of a rainforest. He could feel excitement and arousal coming off her like a glow. He leaned toward her, strained toward her, all of him, and for a moment he could feel her respond with a pure, clean passion. Then she was gone. Arnie sat there, dazed and stupefied, a little to the right of the steering wheel, as Christine's dome light came on. It was brief. The passenger door clunked solidly shut, and the light clicked off again. He sat a moment longer, not sure what had happened, momentarily not even sure where he was. His body was in a complete stew, a helter-skelter array of emotions and erratic physical reactions that were half wonderful and half terrible. His glands hurt. His penis was hard iron. His balls throbbed dully. He could feel adrenaline whipping rapidly through his bloodstream, up and down and all around. He made a fist and brought it down on his leg, hard. Then he slid across the seat, opened the door, and went after her. Lee was standing on the very edge of the embankment, looking down into the darkness. Within a bright rectangle in the middle of that darkness, Sylvester Stallone strode across the night in the costume of a young labor leader from the 1930s. Again, Arnie had that feeling of living in some marvelous dream that might at any moment skew off into nightmare. Perhaps it had already begun to happen. She was too close to the edge. He took her arm and pulled her gently backward. The ground up here was dry and crumbly. There was no fence or guardrail. If the earth at the edge let go, Lee would be gone. She would land somewhere in the suburban development loosely scattered around the Liberty Hill drive-in. The embankment had been the local lover's lane since time out of mind. It was at the end of Stanson Road, a long, meandering stretch of two-lane blacktop that first curved out of town and then hooked back toward it, dead-ending on Libertyville Heights, where there had once been a farm. It was November 4th, and the rain that had begun earlier that Saturday night had turned to a light sleet. They had the embankment and the free, if silent, view of the drive-in to themselves. He got her back into the car. She came willingly enough, thinking it was sleet on her cheeks. It was only inside, by the ghostly green glow of the dashboard lights, that he saw for sure she was crying. "What's the matter?" he asked. "What's wrong?" She shook her head and cried harder. Was this something you didn't want to do?" He swallowed and made himself say it. "Touch me like that?" She shook her head again, but he wasn't sure what that meant. Arnie held her, clumsy and worried, and in the back of his mind he was thinking about the sleet, the trip back down, and the fact that he had no snow tires on Christine as yet.
"I never did that for any boy," she said against his shoulder. "And that's the first time I ever touched, you know. I did it because I wanted to. Because I wanted to, that's all."
"Then what is it?"
"I can't hear."
The words came out slowly and painfully, one at a time, with an almost awful reluctance.
"The embankment?"
Arnie said, gazing around, thinking stupidly that maybe she thought he had really brought her up here so they could watch Fist free.
in this car," she shouted at him suddenly. "I can't make love to you in this car."
"Huh?"
He stared at her, thunderstruck.
"What are you talking about? Why not?"
Because... I don't know." She struggled to say something else and then burst into fresh tears. Arnie held her again until she quieted.
"It's just that... I don't know which you love more," Lee said when she was able.
"That's..." Arnie paused, shook his head, smiled. "Lee, that's crazy."
"Is it?"
she asked, searching his face.
"Which of us do you spend more time with? Me? Or her?"
"You mean Christine?" He looked around him, smiling that puzzled smile that she could find either lovely and lovable or horridly hateful, sometimes both at once.
"Yes," she said tonelessly. "I do."
She looked down at her hands, lying lifelessly on her blue woolen slacks.
"I suppose it's stupid."
"I spend a lot more time with you," Arnie said. He shook his head. "This is crazy. Or maybe it's normal. Maybe it just seems crazy to me, 'cause I never had a girl before."
He reached out and touched the fall of her hair, where it spilled over one shoulder of her open coat. The T-shirt beneath read, "Give me Libertyville or give me death," and her nipples poked at the thin cotton cloth in a sexy way that made Arnie feel a little delirious.
"I thought girls were supposed to be jealous of other girls, not cars."
Lee laughed shortly. "You're right. It must be because you've never had a girl before. Cars are girls. Didn't you know that? Oh, come on. Then why don't you call this Christopher?"
She suddenly slammed her open palm down on the seat, hard. Arnie winced.
"Come on, Lee, don't.
Don't like me slapping your girl?" she asked with sudden and unexpected venom. Then she saw the hurt look in his eyes.
"Arnie, I'm sorry."
"Are you?" he asked, looking at her expressionlessly. "Seems like nobody likes my car these days. You, my dad and mom, even Dennis. I worked my ass off on it, and it means zero to everybody."
"It means something to me," she said softly. "The effort it took."
"Yeah," he said morosely. The passion, the heat, had fled. He felt cold and a little sick to his stomach.
"Look, we better get going. I don't have any snow tires. Your folks would think it was cute, us going bowling and then getting racked up on Stanson Road."
She giggled.
"They don't know where Stanson Road ends up."
He cocked an eyebrow at her, some of his good humor returning.
"That's what you think," he said.
He drove back down toward town slowly, and Christine managed the twisting, steeply descending road with easy, sure-footedness. The sprinkle of earth stars that was Libertyville and Monroeville grew larger and drew closer together, and then ceased to have any pattern at all. Lee watched this a little sadly, feeling that the best part of a potentially wonderful evening had somehow slipped away. She felt irritated, chafed, out of sorts with herself. Unfulfilled, she supposed. There was a dull ache in her breasts. She didn't know if she had meant to let him go what was euphemistically known as all the way or not. But after things had reached a certain point, nothing had gone as she had hoped. All because she had to open her big fat mouth. Her body was in a mess, and her thoughts were the same way. Again and again, on the mostly silent drive back down, she opened her mouth to try to clarify how she felt, and then closed it again, afraid of being misunderstood, because she didn't understand how she felt herself. She didn't feel jealous of Christine, and yet she did. About that, Arnie hadn't told the truth. She had a good idea of how much time he spent tinkering on the car. But was that so wrong? He was good with his hands. He liked to work on it, and it ran like a watch. Except for that funny little glitch with the odometer numbers running backward. "Cars are girls," she had said. She hadn't been thinking of what she was saying. It had just popped out of her mouth. And it certainly wasn't always true. She didn't think of their family sedan as having any particular gender. It was just a Ford. But
Forget it. Get rid of all the hocus-pocus and phony stuff. The truth was much more brutal and even crazier, wasn't it? She couldn't make love to him, couldn't touch him in that intimate way, much less think about bringing him to a climax that way. Or the other, the real way. She had turned that over and over in her mind as she lay in her narrow bed, feeling a new and nearly amazing excitement steal over her. In the car. Not in the car. Because the really crazy part was that she felt Christine was watching them. That she was jealous, disapproving, maybe hating. Because there were times, like tonight, as Arnie skated the Plymouth so smoothly and delicately across the building scales of sleet, when she felt that the two of them, Arnie and Christine, were welded together in a disturbing parody of the act of love. Because Lee did not feel that she rode in Christine. When she got in to go somewhere with Arnie, she felt swallowed in Christine. And the act of kissing him, making love to him, seemed a perversion worse than voyeurism or exhibitionism. It was like making love inside the body of her rival. The really crazy part of it was that she hated Christine, hated her, and feared her. She had developed a vague dislike of walking in front of the new grill, or closely behind the trunk. She had vague thoughts of the emergency brake letting go, or the gear shift popping out of park and into neutral for some reason. Thoughts she had never had about the family sedan. But mostly it was not wanting to do anything in the car, or even go anywhere in the car if she could help it. Arnie seemed somehow different in the car, a person she didn't really know. She loved the feel of his hands on her body, her breasts, her thighs. She had not yet allowed him to touch the center of her, but she wanted his hands there. She thought if he touched her there, she would probably just melt. His touch always brought a coppery taste of excitement to her mouth, a feeling that every sense was alive and deliciously attuned. But in the car, that feeling seemed blunted. Maybe because in the car, Arnie always seemed less honestly passionate, and somehow more lecherous. She opened her mouth again as they turned onto her street, wanting to explain some of this. And again, nothing would come. Why should it? There was really nothing to explain. It was all vapors, nothing but vague humors. Well, there was one thing. But she couldn't tell him that. It would hurt him too badly. She didn't want to hurt him because she thought she was beginning to love him. But it was there. The smell. A rotten, thick smell under the aromas of new seat covers and the cleaning fluid he had used on the floor mats. It was there, faint, but terribly unpleasant, almost stomach-turning. As if, at some time, something had crawled into the car and died there. He kissed her goodnight on her doorstep, the sleet shining silver in the cone of yellow light thrown by the carriage lamp at the foot of the porch steps. It shone in her dark blonde hair like jewels. He would have liked to have really kissed her, but the fact that her parents might be watching from the living room, probably were in fact, forced him to kiss her almost formally, as you might kiss a dear cousin. "I'm sorry," she said. "I was silly." "No," Arnie said, obviously meaning yes. "It's just that..." And her mind supplied her with something that was a curious hybrid of the truth and a lie. "That it doesn't seem right in the car. Any car. I want us to be together, but not parked in the dark at the end of a dead-end road. Do you understand?" "Yes," he said. Up at the embankment in the car, he had felt a little angry with her. Well, to be honest, he'd been pretty goddamn pissed off. But now, standing here on her stoop, he thought he could understand, and marvel that he could want to deny her anything, or cross her will in any way. "I know exactly what you mean." She hugged him, her arms locked around his neck. Her coat was still open, and he could feel the soft, maddening weight of her breasts. "I love you," she said for the first time, and then slipped inside to leave him standing there on the porch momentarily, agreeably stunned and much warmer than he should have been in the ticking, pattering sleet of late autumn. The idea that the Cabots might find it peculiar if he stood on their front stoop much longer in the sleet at last percolated down into his bemused brain. Arnie went back down the walk through the tick and patter, snapping his fingers and grinning. He was riding the roller coaster now, the one that's the best ride, the one they really only let you take once. Near the place where the concrete path joined the sidewalk, he stopped, the smile fading off his face. Christine stood at the curb, drops of melted sleet pearling her glass, smearing the red idiot lights from the dash inside, and he wondered passingly what the source of that particular bit of slang was. Idiot lights. It was an unpleasant term. Then that was wiped out by the more important consideration. He had left Christine running, and she had stalled. This was the second time.
"Wet wires," he muttered under his breath. "That's all."
It couldn't be plugs. He'd put in a whole new set just the day before yesterday at Will's. 8 new champion and...
"Which of us do you spend more time with, me or her?"
The smile returned, but this time it was uneasy. Well, he spent more time around cars in general, of course. That came of working for Will, but it was ridiculous to think that...
"You lied to her.
That's the truth, isn't it?"
"No," he answered himself uneasily. "No, I don't think you could say I really lied to her.
No?
Then just what do you call it?"
For the first and only time since he had taken her to the football game at Hidden Hills, he had told her a big, fat lie. Because the truth was, he spent more time with Christine, and he hated having her parked in the 30-day section of the airport parking lot, out in the wind and rain, soon to be snow. He had lied to her. He spent more time with Christine, and that was
wrong, he croaked,
and the word was almost lost in the slick, mysterious sound of the falling sleet. He stood on the walk, looking at his stalled car, marvelously resurrected time traveler from the era of Buddy Holly and Khrushchev and Laika the space dog. And suddenly he hated it. It had done something to him. He wasn't sure what. Something. The idiot lights, blurred into football-shaped red eyes by the moisture on the window, seemed to mock him and reproach him at the same time. He opened the driver's side door, slipped behind the wheel, and pulled the door shut again. He closed his eyes. Peace flowed over him, and things seemed to come back together. He had lied to her, yes, but it was a little lie, a mostly unimportant lie. No, a completely unimportant lie. He reached out without opening his eyes and touched the leather rectangle the keys were attached to. Old and scuffed, the initials RDL burned into it. He had seen no need to get a new keyring, or a piece of leather with his own initials on it. But there was something peculiar about the leather tab the keys were attached to, wasn't there? Yes, quite peculiar indeed. When he had counted out the cash on LeBay's kitchen table, and LeBay had skittered the keys across the red and white checked oilcloth to him, the rectangle of leather had been scuffed and nicked and darkened by age, the initials almost obliterated by time and the constant friction of rubbing against the change in the old man's pocket and the material of the pocket itself. Now, the initials stood out fresh and clear again. They had been renewed. But like the lie, that was really unimportant. Sitting inside the metal shell of Christine's body, he felt very strongly that that was true. He knew it. Quite unimportant. All of it. He turned the key. The starter whined, but for a long time the engine wouldn't catch. Wet wires, of course, that was what it was.
"Please," he whispered. "It's all right. Don't worry. Everything is the same."
The engine fired. Missed. The starter whined on and on. Sleet ticked coldly on the glass. It was safe in here. It was dry and warm if the engine would start.
"Come on," Arnie whispered. "Come on, Christine, come on, hon."
The engine fired again. Caught. The idiot lights flickered and went out. The gen light pulsed weakly again as the motor stuttered, then went out for good as the beat of the engine smoothed out into a clean hum. The heater blew warm air gently around his legs, negating the winter chill outside. It seemed to him that there were things Lee could not understand, things she could never understand, because she hadn't been around. The pimples, the cries of, hey, pizza face, the wanting to speak, the wanting to reach out to other people, and the inability, the impotence. It seemed to him that she couldn't understand the simple fact that, had it not been for Christine, he never would have had the courage to call her on the phone, even if she had gone around with "I want to date Arnie Cunningham" tattooed on her forehead. She couldn't understand that he sometimes felt 30 years older than his age, no, more like 50, and not a boy at all, but some terribly hurt veteran back from an undeclared war. He caressed the steering wheel. The green cat's eyes on the dash instruments glowed back at him, comfortingly. "Okay," he said, almost sighed. He dropped the gear shift into Big D and flicked on the radio. Dee Dee Sharp singing "Mashed Potato Time," mystic nonsense on the radio waves, coming out of the dark. He pulled out, planning to head for the airport, where he would park his car and catch the bus that ran back to town on the hour, and he did that, but not in time to take the 11 p.m. bus, as he intended. He took the midnight bus instead, and it was not until he was in bed that night, recalling Lee's warm kisses, instead of the way Christine wouldn't fire up, that it occurred to him that somewhere that evening, after leaving the Cabot house and before arriving at the airport, he had lost an hour. It was so obvious that he felt like a man who has turned the house upside down looking for a vital bit of correspondence, only to discover that he has been holding it in his other hand all along. Obvious, and a little scary. Where had he been? He had a blurry memory of drawing away from the curb in front of Lee's and then just cruising. Yeah, cruising. That was all. No big deal. Cruising through the thickening sleet, cruising empty streets that were plated with the stuff, cruising without snow tires, and yet Christine, incredibly sure-footed, never missed her way or skidded around a corner. Christine seemed to find the safe and secure way as if, by magic, the ride as solid as it would have been if the car had been on trolley tracks. Cruising with the radio on, spilling out a constant stream of oldies that seemed to consist solely of girls' names. Peggy Sue, Carol, Barbara Ann, Susie darling. It seemed to him that at some point he had gotten a little frightened and had punched one of the chrome buttons on the converter he'd installed, but instead of FM 104 and the block party weekend, he got WDIL all over again. Only now the disc jockey sounded crazily like Alan Freed, and the voice that followed was that of Screamin' Jay Hawkins, hoarse and chanting, "I put a spell on you, because you're mine." And then at last there had been the airport, with its foul weather lights pulsing sequentially like a visible heartbeat. Whatever had been on the radio faded to a meaningless jumble of static, and he had turned it off. Getting out of the car, he had felt a sweaty, incomprehensible sort of relief. Now he lay in bed, needing to sleep, but unable. The sleet had thickened and curdled into fat white splats of snow. It wasn't right. Something had been started. Something was wrong. He couldn't even lie to himself and say that he didn't know about it. The car, Christine, several people had commented on how beautifully he had restored her. He had driven it to school, and the kids from Auto Shop were all over it. They were underneath it on crawlers to look at the new exhaust system, the new shocks, the bodywork. They were waist-deep in the engine compartment, checking out the belts and the radiator, which was miraculously free of the corrosion and the green gunk that is the residue of years of antifreeze. Checking out the generator and the tight, gleaming pistons socketed in their valves. Even the air cleaner was new, with the numbers 318 painted across the top, raked backward to indicate speed. Yes, he had become something of a hero to his fellow shoppies, and he had taken all the comments and the compliments with just the right deprecatory grin. But even then, hadn't the confusion been there, somewhere deep inside? Sure. Because he couldn't remember what he had done to Christine and what he hadn't. The time spent working on her at Darnell's was nothing but a blur now, like his ride out to the airport earlier this evening had been. He could remember starting the bodywork on the dented rear end, but he couldn't remember finishing it. He could remember painting the hood, covering the windshield and mudguards with masking tape, and donning the white mask in the paint shop out back. But exactly when he had replaced the springs, he couldn't remember. Nor could he remember where he had gotten them. All he could remember for sure was sitting behind the wheel for long periods, stupefied with happiness, feeling the way he had felt when Lee whispered, "I love you," before slipping in her front door. Sitting there, after most of the guys who worked on their cars at Darnell's had gone home to get their suppers, sitting there and sometimes turning on the radio to listen to the oldies on WDIL. Maybe the windshield was the worst. He hadn't bought a new windshield for Christine. He was sure of that. His bank book would be dented a lot more than it was if he'd bought one of those fancy wrap jobs. And wouldn't he have a receipt? He'd even hunted for such a receipt once in the desk file marked car stuff that he kept in his room, but he hadn't found one. And the truth was, he had hunted rather half-heartedly. Dennis had said something, that the snarl of cracks had looked smaller, less serious. Then, that day at Hidden Hills, it had just been, well, gone. The windshield had been clear and unflawed. But when had it happened? How had it happened? He didn't know. He finally fell asleep and dreamed unpleasantly, twisting the covers into a ball as the scud of clouds blew away and the autumnal stars shone coldly down. Chapter 24. Seen in the Night. It was a dream. She was sure, almost until the very end, that it must be a dream. In the dream, she awoke from a dream of Arnie, making love to Arnie, not in the car, but in a very cool blue room that was unfurnished except for a deep blue shag rug and a scatter of throw pillows covered in a lighter blue satin. She awoke from this dream to her room in the small hours of Sunday morning. She could hear a car outside. She went to the window and looked out and down. Christine was standing at the curb. She was running. Lee could see exhaust raftering up from the straight pipes, but was empty. In the dream, she thought that Arnie must be at the door, although there was no knock as yet. She ought to go down, and quickly. If her father woke up and found Arnie here at 4 in the morning, he would be furious. But she didn't move. She looked down at the car and thought how much she hated it and feared it, and it hated her, too. Rivals, she thought, and the thought in this dream was not grim and hotly jealous, but rather despairing and afraid. There it sat at the curb. There it was. There she was, parked outside her house in the dead trench of morning, waiting for her, waiting for Lee. "Come on down, honey. Come on. We'll cruise, and we'll talk about who needs him more, who cares for him more, and who will be better for him in the long run. Come on. You're not scared, are you?" She was terrified. "It's not fair. She's older. She knows the tricks. She'll beguile him." "Get out," Lee whispered fiercely in the dream, and rapped softly on the glass with her knuckles. The glass felt cold to her touch. She could see the small crescent-shaped marks her knuckles left in the frost. It was amazing how real some dreams could be. But it had to be a dream. It had to be because the car heard her. The words were no more than out of her mouth when the wipers suddenly started up, flicking wet snow off the windshield in somehow contemptuous swipes, and then it, or she, drew smoothly away from the curb and was gone up the street, with no one driving it. She was sure of that, as sure as one can be of anything in a dream.
The passenger window had been dusted with snow, but was not opaque with it. She had been able to see inside, and there was no one behind the wheel, so of course it had to be a dream. She drifted back to her bed, into which she had never brought a lover. Like Arnie, she had never had a lover at all. Thinking of a Christmas quite long ago, 12, maybe even 14 years ago, surely she could have been no more than 4 at the time. She and her mother had been in one of the big department stores in Boston, Filene's maybe. She put her head down on her pillow and fell asleep, in her dream, with her eyes open, looking at the faint gleam of early light in the window. And then, in dreams anything could happen, she saw the Filene's toy department on the other side of the window. Tinsel, glitter, lights. They were looking for something for Bruce, mother and dad's only nephew. Somewhere a department store Santa Claus was ho-ho-hoing into a PA system, and the amplified sound was not jolly, but somehow ominous, the laughter of a maniac who had come in the night, not with presents, but with a meat cleaver. She had held out her hand toward one of the displays, had pointed and told her mother that she wanted Santa Claus to bring her that. "No, honey, Santa can't bring you that. That's a boy toy." "But I want it." "Santa will bring you a nice doll, maybe even a Barbie." "Want that?" "Only boy elves make those, Lily, my love, for boys. The nice girl elves make nice dolls."
"I don't want a doll. I don't want a Barbie. I want that."
"If you're going to throw a tantrum, I'll have to take you home, Lee. I mean it, now." So she had submitted. And Christmas had brought her not only Malibu Barbie, but also Malibu Ken. And she had enjoyed them, she supposed, but still she remembered the red Remco racing car on its green surface of painted hills, running without a cord along a painted road so perfect that there were even tiny metal guardrails, a road whose essential illusion was given away only by its pointless circularity. Ah, but it ran fast, that car, and was it bright red magic in her eye and her mind? It was. And the car's essential illusion was also magic. That illusion was somehow so captivating that it stole her heart. The illusion, of course, was that the car was driving itself. She knew that a store employee was really controlling it from a booth to the right, pushing buttons on a square wireless device. Her mother told her that was how it was happening, and so it must be so, but her eyes denied it. Her heart denied it. She stood, fascinated, her small gloved hands on the rail of the display area, watching it race around and around, moving fast, driving itself, until her mother pulled her gently away. And over everything, seeming to cause the very tinsel strung along the ceiling to vibrate, the ominous laughter of the department store Santa. Lee slept more deeply, dreams and memories slowly fading. And outside, daylight came creeping in like cold milk, illuminating a street that was Sunday morning empty and Sunday morning silent. The season's first fall of snow was unmarred except for the tire tracks that swerved to the curb in front of the cabin house and then moved smoothly away again toward the intersection at the end of this suburban block. She didn't rise until nearly 10 o'clock. Her mother, who didn't believe in slug-a-beds, finally called for her to come down and have breakfast before lunch. And by then, the day had already warmed up to nearly 60 degrees. In western Pennsylvania, early November is apt to be every bit as capricious as early April. So, by 10 o'clock, the snow had melted. And the tracks were gone. Chapter 25. Buddy visits the airport. One night, some 10 days later, as cardboard turkeys and construction paper cornucopias were beginning to appear in grammar school windows, a blue Camaro, so radically jacked in the back that its nose seemed almost to scrape the road, slid into the long-term parking lane at the airport. Sandy Galton looked out from his glass booth nervously. From the driver's side of the Chevrolet, the happy, smiling face of Buddy Repperton tilted up toward him. Buddy's face was scrubbed with a week-old beard, and his eyes held a maniacal glitter that was more cocaine than Thanksgiving cheer. He and the boys had scored a pretty good gram that evening. All in all, Buddy looked quite a bit like a depraved Clint Eastwood. "How are they hanging, Sandy?" Buddy asked.
Dutiful laughter from the Camaro greeted this sally. Don Vandenberg, Moochie Welch, and